All right, so today we are continuing our reading and discussion of The Mass Line and the American Revolutionary Movement by Scott Harrison. This isn't the only thing that we'll be doing for the next couple months. I have a couple other podcast or like episode ideas that I really want to do. But this is something that we'll be doing frequently. And today we're discussing Chapter 5, Who Are the Masses? What we're going to do is we're going to start off just by reading the entire chapter. It's about 20 minutes long. And then I'll follow up with like 5-10 minutes of some reflection points, ideas that were generated from my reading of the text. And before we get started, I want to say thank you to all the new Patreon supporters for supporting the show. If you haven't checked it out, there are free resources on Patreon as well, so would love for you to see that stuff and share with some comrades. Thanks to everyone who shared the show, left a rating and review. That all amplifies this podcast, and I appreciate it. Okay, let's go ahead and dive in. Again, I'm going to start off by reading through the whole chapter, and I will meet you on the end with some reflection points. So let's get to it. Who are the masses? We cannot speak intelligently of the mass line unless we have some idea of who the masses are. You can look up the word masses in a dictionary where you will find definitions such as the whole people, ordinary people, the great body of people as contrasted with the upper classes, the working classes, the proletariat, and the lower social orders. But of course, these definitions differ somewhat among themselves, which merely shows that the word masses, like most words, is used in various different ways in ordinary speech. However, just as the word mass receives a single definite meaning in physics, a meaning which is, in fact, dependent upon overall physical theory, so in genuine social science, historical materialism, does the word masses receive a definite meaning which is dependent upon the overall scientific theory of Marxism? The masses are composed of classes and strata. The predominant level of social analysis in Marxist theory is that of social classes, which are, approximately, groups of people having a common relationship to the means of production. Thus, not only in a society as a whole analyzed in terms of classes, but so are subsections of the population, such as the masses. Specifically, Marxism divides all of the society into various social classes in accordance with the level of development of the class society in question, and then separates these various classes into two groups: the masses, or the people, and the enemy. The masses are the social classes which represent progress and social development in accordance with the Marxist theory of historical materialism, while the enemy is the class, or classes, whose vested interests lie in the preservation of the given stage of society, and who oppose any further social development. It is in the interests of the masses to make revolution, while it is in the interests of the enemy, classes, to oppose revolution. In capitalist society, it is the proletariat, which is the most revolutionary class, the staunchest and most resolute, the only class which has nothing to lose and everything to gain by advancing society to socialism and then communism. For this reason, it is the proletariat which forms the core of the masses, its central and leading component. Similarly, it is the capitalist class, the bourgeoisie, which has the most to lose by the destruction of capitalist society and its replacement by communism. And therefore, it is the bourgeoisie which forms the core of the enemy camp. All other classes are faced with the choice of adhering to one or the other of these two poles, and generally show ambivalence and vacillation in doing so. Consequently, the masses-enemy dichotomy is not quite so clean as implied above, since in the case of the intermediate classes, some sections will belong to the masses and other sections will form part of the enemy camp. In the US, for example, the large petty bourgeoisie is split, with some sections and individuals siding, at least potentially, with the proletariat, thus counting as part of the masses. In other sections and individuals siding with the bourgeoisie and thus counting as part of the enemy. Even the proletariat and bourgeoisie themselves have individual traitors and defectors from their ranks to the other side. Nevertheless, the overall picture can only be comprehended when the masses are understood in terms of classes and strata, right? Sections of classes. Namely, in the U.S. today, the proletariat and its allies from other classes, and when the enemy is understood as the bourgeoisie and its allies from other classes. The masses and the enemy are therefore strategic concepts. It is irrelevant that the masses, including most of the proletariat, are for long periods unconscious of their revolutionary interests and historical role. What matters is that when the masses do become conscious of these things, society will be changed. Thus, the conscious revolutionary forces at the present time amount only to a tiny part of the masses. But from a strategic point of view, it is nevertheless the broad masses that are the indispensable force which will make the revolution. The masses will be able to make revolution because of their strength of numbers. They comprise the great majority of the population. And because they are the ones who actually make society function. Since it is the masses who do all the work, produce all the goods, and provide all the services. The bourgeoisie amounts to only a couple percent of the population, and even adding in its probable allies from the petty bourgeoisie doesn't change the fact that the enemy is a tiny minority. In a mother imperialist country, the enemy is a relatively larger percentage of the population than in the quote-unquote third world. This is because of the extra riches sucked into the imperialist center from around the world, and the greater success the bourgeoisie has in buying off or otherwise winning over sections of the masses. But even so, the enemy is still a small part of the population. But for a contrasting diachronic view of the situation, see below. Its rule is maintained through ideological domination on the one hand and through armed force on the other. As Lenin put it, the bourgeoisie rules by means of the priest and the gendarme. But the ultimate armed force, the army, is comprised predominantly of working class soldiers. Thus, no matter how solid their rule may appear at any particular time, historically speaking, it is extremely precarious. When in a time of severe economic crisis and or war, the bourgeoisie loses its ideological grip on the masses, and a revolutionary party, which has already made some headway among them, steps forward to lead the masses in revolt, their army will split and crumble. Insurrection and civil war will defeat the bourgeoisie and their allies and lackeys. A diachronic view of the masses. So far, I have been speaking of the masses as if it were a concept that remains unchanged through time, at least within a given historical period. This synchronic view of the masses is, in fact, its basic meaning. Its meaning in the strategic sense already discussed. But the concept masses can also be viewed diachronically, as a category which changes through time. This is most obvious when we consider who the masses are in a completely different historical situation than our own, say in slave society in ancient times, or in the period of the New Democratic Revolution in China, which Mao led to victory in 1949. In the later case, the masses had a different composition, even definition, than in an advanced capitalist country such as the US. The main difference there was that the peasantry made up the great bulk of the masses, even though the proletariat was still its leading core in the ideological sense. In the former case, ancient slave society, no proletariat, properly speaking, even existed, nor bourgeoisie either. The masses were made up of the slaves and a section of the class of quote-unquote freemen, who formed their allies, while the enemy was the class of aristocratic slave owners, together with the other section of quote-unquote freemen, who aspired to the aristocracy or at least feared slave uprisings. And speaking of the masses in ancient society, we are, of course, applying a modern analytical concept which does not exist at that time. Whether there was an analogous concept in Greek or Latin, for example, I don't know, though I doubt it very much. Slaves were not generally considered as part of the people at all. Less obvious, perhaps, is the diachronic use of the category the masses within a single historical period. Lenin explains that the concept of masses, quote, is one that changes in accordance with the changes in the nature of the struggle. At the beginning of the struggle, it took only a few thousand genuinely revolutionary workers to warrant talk of the masses. In the history of our movement and of our struggle against the Mensheviks, you will find many examples where several thousand workers in a town were enough to give a clearly mass character to the movement. When the revolution has been sufficiently prepared, the concept masses becomes different. Several thousand workers no longer constitute the masses. The concept of masses undergoes a change so that it implies the majority, and not simply a majority of the workers alone, but a majority of all the exploited. End quote. The issue of whether a majority of the masses must invariably be won to the side of the revolution before the seizure of power will be discussed later in the book. Whichever way we finally decide on that issue, it remains true that the strategic concept of the masses includes the great majority of the population, even though at any point in the struggle, a portion of the masses, and sometimes quite a large portion, will be temporarily siding with the enemy. If that much were not true, the whole class struggle would be over immediately. Lenin is arguing in the above quote that it is certainly correct to speak of demonstrations and actions by the masses in the early stages of the revolutionary struggle, even though only a few thousand non-party people take part in them. It is correct because the actions of these thousands represent what is arising and developing. Because they are the early movement of a small part of the masses, which foreshadows the movement of the majority. Because it shows that some of the masses have already been won to conscious revolutionary action, and because they are actions which go beyond the activity of the party, a highly organized but handful of people, relatively speaking. But Lenin is also insisting that strategically, the masses can only be viewed as the overwhelming majority of the exploited, and that in speaking of revolution by the masses, we are speaking of the action of millions, not thousands. One can say either, number one, that the word masses has two senses. First, a fundamental strategic sense in which it refers to 90% of the population, and second, a derivative sense in which it refers to a part of this 90% which represents the potential and future of the whole. Or, number two, that the word masses always means this 90% of the population in a given historical epoch, and that a phrase such as, quote, a demonstration by the masses totaling 3,000 people, end quote, is elliptical for a more precise formulation such as, quote, a demonstration by a part of the masses representing the interests of the masses as a whole, totaling 3,000 people, end quote. I prefer the second formulation, but either way, it amounts to the same thing and should not be allowed to lead to the kind of confusion and error which Lenin found necessary to expose and attack. Class analysis. In order to make revolution, a much more careful and detailed class analysis must be made than I am attempting here. It is not enough to say, for example, who the masses are in an overall strategic sense. Further analysis must determine which sections of the masses, and even which sections of the proletariat, are most open to revolutionary ideas, and where the proletarian party should concentrate its forces. A good start towards such an analysis has been made by the Revolutionary Communist Party. One of the essential points to grasp is that in the imperialist countries, and the US in particular, a section of the workers themselves has been embourgeoisied, granted some major concessions by the bourgeoisie so that they also have something of a stake in the current system. Not only is there a labor aristocracy, but large sections of the unionized industrial proletariat and other workers in certain service sectors, for example, computer programmers, are distinctly better off than the lower level basic proletarians. Because the economic situation of the various strata of the workers differs so greatly, their ideology also differs. The basic proletariat, made up of those who truly have nothing to lose but their chains, is of course the most fertile ground for revolutionary ideas, and consequently for the application of the mass line. The reason why the bourgeoisie has been able to partially buy off a section of the masses is that capitalism has become a world economic system. With the advent of imperialism, the struggle between the workers and the capitalists has become more international than ever. To a major extent, even a proper class analysis can only be made on a world scale. The masses in the third world countries have become more oppressed and exploited, partly in order that the imperialists may grant more concessions to their workers in the mother countries, and thus keep things more stable at home. This makes revolution in the imperialist countries more difficult, but it accelerates the development of the objective conditions for revolution in the imperialist-dominated third world countries. Increased stability at home means decreased stability in the empire. All this does not mean, however, that revolution is impossible in the imperialist countries until it has completely triumphed in the third world. For one thing, the imperialists will have to constantly be fighting neo-colonial wars, and the struggle against imperialist war can become a revolutionary issue at home, as it did with the Vietnam War. In addition to this, there is still the possibility of inter-imperialist world war, despite the temporary easing of tensions with the collapse of the Soviet brand of state capitalism and major economic collapse. Since about 1970, the economy has been kept afloat by mushrooming debt, on the one hand, and by pushing down large sections of the workers, on the other hand. Neither of these can continue indefinitely without leading to an explosion. It is particularly ironic that the imperialists should have come to the point that they must start taking back the crumbs they have been using to buy off a section of the workers. We have entered a period where the embourgeoisied proletariat is beginning to be re-proletarianized. While it is reasonable to expect that revolution in the third world in the immediate future is more probable than revolution in the Western imperialist countries, no one can be certain of exactly how events will unfold. It is the duty of revolutionaries everywhere to constantly work for revolution and try to be ready for the opportunity if it should suddenly materialize. The advanced, intermediate, and backward masses. The masses, encompassing as they do the greatest part of the population and diverse classes and strata, such as the proletariat, part of the petty bourgeoisie, and part of the lumpen proletariat, and coming from widely scattered localities, having vast differences in background, experience, education, etc., are bound to show many different levels of political consciousness. As many divisions can be made here as suits your purpose. The advanced and the backward, or the very active, those just beginning to move, and the inactive, and so forth. One could list 10 or 20 levels of consciousness, experience, and or activity if one chose. Generally, however, it has proven most useful to conceptually divide the masses into three parts: the relatively advanced, the intermediate, and the relatively backward. This can be done with respect to a specific social question or issue, such as people's varying attitudes towards the oppression of women, or in general, that is, with respect to their understanding of their overall situation and class interests and their general revolutionary consciousness. Of course, the consciousness of individuals and also of the masses as a whole changes with time as a result of their experiences and the ideological class struggle. Likewise, who we consider to be advanced or backward will also change with the situation. The fact that the masses are never a uniform, homogeneous mass has extremely important implications. It explains both why the mass line is possible and why it is necessary. The mass line is possible because among the masses there are individuals with correct ideas about how to move the revolutionary struggle forward in a given situation. The mass line is necessary because, at first, only a few people hold correct ideas, and these ideas must be collected, identified as correct, and then popularized among the masses as a whole before they can be made effective use of. If the masses were uniformly advanced, the mass line, and leadership in general, would be unnecessary. If the masses were uniformly backward, the mass line would be impossible, and so would revolution. The mass line is based on actual reality, neither idealizing the masses nor belittling them. It recognizes their differences, both in overall consciousness and with respect to specific ideas about how to advance a revolutionary struggle, and makes use of the advanced ideas of some of the masses to help educate and lead the masses as a whole. The masses and the party. The fundamental division in society is between the masses and the enemy. Looking at things from this overall point of view, the proletarian party is part of the masses. However, as we have seen, the masses are by no means homogeneous. Being composed of some more advanced and more active people, some intermediate, and some relatively backward or inactive. The very most advanced and active will organize themselves into a leading body, the proletarian party. This party plays such an important role in the revolutionary process, and its relationship to the rest of the masses is of such a crucial nature that it is customary to distinguish the two and reserve the term the masses for the rest of the masses other than the proletarian party. In other words, in addition to the fundamental dichotomy between the masses and the enemy, there is a second dichotomy between the masses and the party. This subsidiary distinction is, of course, of a completely different character. Instead of two irreconcilable, antagonistic poles, it is a distinction within a single political pole between the most advanced detachment and the rest, between the leadership and the led. Okay, that wraps up our reading for today, Chapter 5, Who Are the Masses? And now, to conclude this episode, I want to offer just a few reflection points. The first thing I wanted to point out is that the masses is not a non-class term. We're not speaking of the masses in a liberal or populist sense here. For revolutionary communists, the masses are, most importantly, classed. And because class struggle is the primary motor of human history, we think in terms of how people objectively relate to one another within a society's process of production and distribution. We are unable to correctly understand who the masses are, let alone develop a mass line per a given situation, if we reject the science of historical materialism. The development of a mass line assumes that a party or organization adheres to a scientific understanding of the revolutionary class line. One cannot be for reformism, abandoning the proletariat's historical task altogether, or eclecticism, seeing class not as, generally speaking, the primary determinative force, but merely one among numerous equally primary forces, and properly develop a mass line. Because while these ideological errors, right, reformism and eclecticism, steer the masses down the road of their endless exploitation and subordination, they also opt for idealist and non-scientific analyses of the objective conditions, the relations between classes, the composition of each class, the principal and secondary character of a contradiction, the principal and secondary aspect of a particular contradiction, and so on. The mass line is a method of leadership for revolutionary militants committed to the object of revolutionary science, namely class revolution. We are not bourgeois, Marxist in name reformists, and there is no such thing as a mass line that serves a so-called peaceful transition to socialism. So at the risk of being redundant, I'm trying to make clear that the mass line can only be developed scientifically. And so if an organization has revised the revolutionary science, or even rejects that Marxism is a science at all, then it will never successfully develop programs that truly adhere to the mass line and will forever tail or command the masses with their programs and slogans. Why is this important, you might ask? Well, for one, developing programs along a revolutionary class line helps us understand what a united front is and is not. A united front, for example, is not when a revolutionary organization or party collaborates with other organizations in a kind of alliance or populist movement. The revisionist parties in France that Richard Wolff has been celebrating lately is a great example of this. United Front work isn't an alliance of different groups or organizations. Rather, United Front work is when the revolutionary proletariat and their party strategically leads other classes in struggles against common enemies and for common goals. But if an organization rejects the revolutionary class line, it is easy to see how people can mistake movementist alliance efforts for United Front work. Next, a correct understanding of who the masses are takes into account both the objective and subjective character of the masses. Members of the working class in a capitalist society are understood to be the primary part of the masses because of their concrete position in a society and their objective relation to the means of production. This does not mean that all of the proletariat will necessarily make up the revolutionary proletariat, which is why we in the U.S. must take seriously the ways in which racialization, gender, sexuality, and nationality overdetermine class composition here fundamentally. But this does mean that the objective position of a person in a society's process of production, not the ideas they presently subscribe to, is most important when identifying, defining, and analyzing the masses. But on the other hand, the ideas of the masses, especially the petite bourgeoisie, do impact one's inclusion into the majority of the masses or the minority enemy. The petite bourgeoisie is a bit larger in imperial centers like the US than it is in semi-colonies, but it would be an immense error for a socialist movement in the United States to simply write all petite bourgeois persons off as reactionary. Many can, and frankly need to be, persuaded to the side of the revolutionary proletariat against the bourgeoisie. To immediately treat petite bourgeois persons, or even everyone in the proletariat with reactionary ideas on some subjects, as enemies, is to misunderstand and mishandle the contradictions, thus slowing down our struggle for freedom and power. And so, while concrete analysis of concrete conditions is primarily of that which is objective, the realm of culture and people's ideas contribute to the defining of who the masses are in a given society as well. The third point that came to my mind while I read this chapter deals with the Marxist theory of knowledge. Because Harrison mentions that the masses must become ever more conscious, right? You know, this is a fundamental objective for communism, the development of mass consciousness and participation, as opposed to the subordination and being controlled that exists in every class society of the masses. And as Maoists, you know, we move from practice to knowledge and back to practice. But this is not simply how the slightly advanced of the advanced come to correct understanding and programs, right? The masses, too, become ever more conscious of who they really are and how to win their freedom through the dialectical process of practice, knowledge, practice. For more on the Marxist theory of knowledge, start with Mao's super short where do correct ideas come from, and then his brief on practice. And so as we start to wrap up here, I also thought it was worth mentioning that when developing our class analysis and our understanding of who the masses are, some Maoists in the U.S. wrongly believe that everyone who does not adhere to the revolutionary science of Marxism, Leninism, Maoism is an enemy. I have heard this come up in several conversations in the last year or two, and while it may seem correct in theory to some, this assumption is undergirded by seeing all contradictions as antagonistic. But as Mao helps us see in On Contradiction, the dialectical materialist understanding of contradiction sees how contradictions can either be antagonistic or non-antagonistic. And so, if your organization treats every other organization, every other group with a different ideology, every other non-revolutionary activist or organizer or worker as being the enemy because they obviously put into practice ideas that are incorrect, which is to say counter-revolutionary or bourgeois, you will never be able to organize the masses, because why would anyone follow someone who acts like they are their enemy? If you truly believe every organizer and activist out there that isn't Marxist, Leninist, Maoist is simply your enemy, you will endlessly alienate yourself from the masses and never be able to win over, organize, or lead anyone. And so, knowing whether an organization or organizer is presently non-antagonistic or antagonistic toward a revolutionary struggle is an essential aspect of our scientific analysis, because this changes how we should relate to them in a given situation or particular stage of a struggle. And so, to wrap up this episode, I want to name that no organization in the U.S., to my knowledge, has produced a class analysis of the United States, or even a particular region or area, you know, a cadre might be working in. And our work will continue to sorely lack if we do not develop our mass work upon concrete analysis of concrete conditions. So, who are the masses in the United States? We cannot afford to be abstract and idealist with our answer to this question. We need to be scientific and concrete. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thanks for sharing with comrades, and we will talk soon.